Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust way back in 2002. We're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com. This week we speak to local man Mark Pope, whose father was the author of children's railway stories published in the 1970s. Those books now going for sometimes hundreds of pounds. Also, Texas radio talk show host George Butler speaks to us about the death of US conspiracy scholar Jim Mars. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk. And if you want to join in, contact the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street. And I'll give full contact details at the end of the show. Right, well, now I'm joined by Mark Pope, who's come all the way from Marshfield. Is that in Wiltshire? It's not quite that, maybe that far out.
It's South Gloucestershire.
South Gloucestershire, Mark. Mm. But you've brought with you a collection of books by your father, Ray Pope, all about railways. The first one here is called The Model Railway Men. And I'm guessing that that was the first one, and then there are other railway men or model railway men books after that.
Yes, that's right, yes. The first one was The Model Railway Men, and it was quite popular, and we're talking about back in the 70s, and the publisher then wanted more books written, which were done.
So originally published in 1970. Tell us about your dad who wrote the books.
Well, he was a teacher, and he taught in Chippenham and one or two other places.
Taught what and what age children?
Geography, secondary school, kids. So he, and in his spare time, he wrote these books.
I think in the 70s, actually, it was probably a lot easier to get things published than it is today. But what was the inspiration behind the books?
Well, I think he found that by watching his sons, and particularly me, playing with the model railway, that gave him some ideas. And also, I think he was very interested in people, and he had a view of the world, and I think he wanted to combine the two so that they could learn or see things from a different perspective. And so he created this miniature world.
So just, I mean, how does it work where you're actually writing about a model railway rather than a real railway?
Well, I suppose a model railway is, perhaps he thought about it as being more of how is the perfect world going to be versus the real world and compared the two.
So he was almost imagining what you were imagining as a child playing with your model railway set.
To some extent, yeah. I think he did take what, you know, we did as kids and included it in the books.
And what sort of themes are in there? Because I mean, I have to remember that 1970 was the end of the 1960s, which was the era of the beaching cuts, massive cuts to the railway network around the country, and of course the end of steam.
Yes. Well, there's all kinds of themes. People come into the story from outside, and also the model railwaymen move out of the attic into the greater world. And
so how do they do that? So they're on the model railway set in the attic. How are they getting out from there into the real world?
Well, Mark carries them out either in his pocket or he likes to carry a coach with them inside and takes them off around to various places.
Let's look at some of the themes in the books. This is the first one, The Model Railway Men.
Yeah.
We don't want to spoil too much, but the second book in the series is Telford and the American Visitor.
Yeah. That's where I think we get into a slight political element, as in, well, what does the American Visitor represent? Because he is the son of a business associate of Mark's father, and the American Visitor comes to visit Mark's father, and the son stays in the house with Mark. So we find that the American Visitor brings with him a lot of rolling stock, because he's also a model railway person. And this is of great interest to the model railwaymen on the layout.
So what's it like for you now as an adult looking back and reading these books which were written about you as a child?
Absolutely amazing, because, you know, the last time I really looked at them, I was looking at them from a child's perspective, and I saw them as just, at that time, as a good read. You know, they were a good story about model railways and model roadmen, but when you come back later, you know, since I was a child, I've got married, had a career and all kinds of things. It's only fairly recently that I got back to looking at them and thinking, well, just a minute, there's more to this than meets the eye. You know, there are layers of story as to who are these characters. And if you look at many other children's stories and even adults' stories, but particularly children's stories, there are layers and there are different characters who appear, who represent good and bad and things like that. And who are they based on? So that's what I began to see.
I think that's probably fair to say about all the best children's stories, is that they, you know, there's something in there for the adults that are reading them too.
Yeah, absolutely.
And what about the next one, The Model Railway Men Take Over? That sounds a bit scary. Are they taking over the attic? What are they up to?
Well, they're taking over the house. It's a bit like a Home Alone, really. And because Mark and his mother and father go away on holiday, and so the model roadmen have the house to themselves.
Right, well, we won't go too deep into what happens, but I would imagine there's some sort of disaster. Anyway, Telford's Holiday.
Telford's Holiday is where they go out. They go further afield. In fact, they go to places like Chippenham, and they get involved in going on the river, making their own raft and things like that.
Okay, so again, we're seeing quite a lot of Telford here. Who is this guy?
Well, Telford is probably based on a working man who's worked on the railways, a kind of sort of the earth type, of the kind that you would find or associate with many people back in the 70s or even today who were your standard worker, you know.
What about the Thomas the Tank Engine stories? Because, I mean, this was, I suppose, in a way, trying to pick up on this fad for children's books about trains at the time.
Well, I think Thomas the Tank fills in a slightly different sort of idea, and it's also based for younger people, slightly younger than perhaps this age group.
Yeah, so this is maybe for teenagers, where that's for kind of very early kind of junior school. No, maybe even infant school children's stories.
Yeah.
And what about Telford? What's he up to at the Festiniog Railway?
Well, they go up there and they meet, they go up there and they study the whole railway and basically have a pretty good time going around it.
And Telford saves the line. Now, this definitely must have some sort of implications with the beaching cuts, because that was the era where there was campaigns around the country to save railway lines.
Yeah, that's right. So in this one, Telford saves the line by basically they decide to have a display within a model railway show. So they move some of the track to the model railway show, and there they give a speech from voices from that they can't see. Obviously, these are little people. They give a speech about how important it is to have railways and the kind of contribution they make to society and that sort of thing. And what happens is that a rich American called Zach gets to hear about this story, and he comes along and he has made quite a lot of money, and he also is very astute, and he sees some footprints. And he himself has a disability, and he works out that there's more to this than meets the eye, and so he offers to help out, providing he finds out where these voices came from, because it's quite obviously not Mark, because he's a young man. And the other voices are a mixture of voices, and they are obviously different.
The beaching cuts, what did your dad think about those? And because I imagine there's bits and pieces of that weaved in the whole series of books.
Yeah, there are bits and pieces of it, and obviously he wasn't very keen on it. And I was lucky enough to go on the last train, or one of the last trains on the Somerset and Dorset out of Bath at the time, so I've got vague memories of that.
So that goes down to Radstock, doesn't it? And it used to carry a lot of holiday traffic down to the south coast. Absolutely. From up north.
Absolutely, yes, it did. And it used to connect up with main lines, and people could virtually go from Birmingham to Bournemouth without getting off the train, as far as I know. But, the beaching cuts saw fit to get rid of that.
Of course, I mean, nowadays, you know, we're looking at motorways that were built in the 1960s too and 70s.
Yeah.
And pretty much everybody seems to travel around by car now.
Yeah. And we can see the consequences of that in as much as traffic jams. And you have to wonder at the time, you know, why was this thought to be a good idea? The population was growing. Although there was perhaps a little bit of excess railway around, but there seemed to be a move towards just getting rid of a large chunk of it.
Well, I think you've got to look at who benefits, haven't you?
Yes.
And who benefits? Well, the oil companies.
Well, it would appear that they there's evidence to support that, yes.
Well, and also, of course, the car companies. Okay, so Telford Goes Dutch is the next in the series.
Yeah, well, that's where they go overseas and to Holland, and they meet up with they find that there's another family over there. So, you know, the theme is that to reach out to other people who are on your same wavelength and get together.
And finally, Telford Tells the Truth.
Yeah, Telford Tells the Truth is one that I have to get around to rereading, because it's I've read so many of them, and they're hard to get through. In terms of, they're quite emotional for me, but so that's to do with how Telford tells the truth about how he got to be in the model railway business and that sort of, in the railway industry.
So you're getting confused between real railway and model railway.
That's right. Yeah. Well, it's real life, and
it sounds like actually a little bit surreal, the idea of.
Oh, it is. Yeah. Yeah, it is surreal. You have to step outside of a bit like if you read any story, children's stories, you need to step into a different kind of headspace, and that's what makes them potentially quite interesting, perhaps for adults to have a look at, and with their kids as well.
What about the price of them? Because just looking at the second-hand price for some of these books, you're talking about hundreds of pounds.
Yeah, I think that some of the ones that are hundreds of pounds, that's to do with an Amazon algorithm, because I've looked into that, and it's gone even higher than that. But they generally were selling, or are selling, for example, the first one, Model Railwayman, usually selling for about between £20 and £40 for the original copy.
But you can actually get second editions, etc., for £2 or £3. So it's not going to break the bank to get hold of at least one of these books.
Oh no! You can get the second hand. You can get the original copies on Amazon for a reasonable price. But yeah, they are quite expensive. So. The reason being, I think, is they're becoming slightly collector's items. And, I looked at them at these prices. And I thought, why is this? What's going on? So I thought I'd better get them back into print.
Yeah, well, how are you getting on with that?
Well, I've got the first one back into print. And the second one, well, the first, second and third are all available on the Kindle. It's work in progress.
Here we go. Ray Pope Publishing.
Yeah.
So that's, you've managed to get this self-published back into print, yeah?
Yeah. I'm doing it self-publishing because you can get a publisher, but I'd prefer to do things myself, really.
Yeah, the thing is, I mean, a publisher can help market it as well, though, Mark. But anyhow, what about you? Have you got a train set still?
No, I don't. But I'm intending to get one, back again. Because
what do you think is the fascination?
Well, I think it's to do with it's actually to do with maybe the inner child. We all have to look after our inner child and have a bit of fun sometimes, to stay connected and. That's the way that gives you good mental health. And there are quite a number of celebrities who are interested in model railways. So,
but don't get obsessed, folks.
No, absolutely.
Some people do, don't they? They spend thousands and thousands, well, yeah, and thousands, have an enormous great, create their own little world.
Absolutely.
And you wonder, you know, there's people who are starving out there, on, you know, begging for food. And you're spending loads and loads of money creating this little world that no one will ever see apart from you.
Yeah.
Although, of course, the fascination from trains is a bit bigger, isn't it, in a way, in that it was something which is very quintessentially British. You know, nowadays it seems that you're not really supposed to be patriotic and whatever. But this is something very British. And also... It worked a lot better than the roads and the motorways. It's quite nice to see something where you think, well, at least we've preserved it, even if it is in my attic.
Yeah, I think so. There is some of that, and we can see, you know, what with the HS2 coming up, there's more interest in the railways and what is their contribution, what was it like in the past, and how can we make it better in the future? The hall was very quiet and still as the gathering listened. There was such an air of competency and authority about it that they just had to listen. Then the calm voice of Stradley could be heard. Mark knew what an effort it must have been to that quiet man, but he was talking of something he knew. A driver works his way up from fireman, said Stradley, or perhaps I'd better say from labourer because he starts as an engine cleaner. As he bikes to the engine shed with the birds singing and the dawn breaking, he dreams about driving a mainline express. But the first job is cleaning out the ash pit. You see, the locos are brought in over the pit and the ash and clinker is raked through the fire bars into the pit. The more clinker there is, the more acid fumes burn your throat, and as you shuffle the ash and clinker up into the tip wagon, dust flies everywhere. A pair of boots soon gets ruined as you're standing and working with the hot clinker and ash. As a change, you get to load the tenders with coal, and that's where you start to learn about coal too, that it's not all nicely sized, easily handled. So this goes on, and this is what people listen to at the Model Railway Show. Eventually, this impassioned speech gets through to be heard by Zach, who is an American philanthropist who is interested in saving the line.
So who's giving the speech?
That's one of the characters, one of the model railmen called Stradley. They're all named after famous engineers. So they're giving the speech in this Model Railway Exhibition Hall, although they can't be seen, but by the use of microphones, etc., their voice can be heard. So this is the voice of the small man talking impassionately about what's important in the world.
And that extract is from which book?
That's from Telford Saves the Line, which is not actually back in print yet, but it's in the pipeline to be done.
I imagine that copy you've got in your hand there is worth a few £100.
Well, it could be. It's definitely worth, definitely more than £20 to £50. Yeah, something like that. But it's really where you get it from. So when it's back in print, it won't be anywhere near as much as that. And in fact, the Kindle versions will be cheaper because the books themselves are only about 100 pages or less and maybe 20,000 words. So they add up to about 9 books, or there are 9 books, and there may be an extra one which is unprinted, which I'm looking into getting printed eventually.
Now, you mentioned going on the Somerset and Dorset with your dad. Are there any other railway memories you've got with him?
Yeah, we did go to the Barry Island where they cut up the old trains. And
oh, gosh, it's like the graveyard.
Yeah, a graveyard of trains. And that appears in one of the books. So basically a lot of the things that we did would end up in the books. And so I thought to myself, well, if what we did ended up there, who are these other characters and what do they represent and where do they come from? So I'm looking for other people to perhaps tell me who or what do they see in there, because there he was, my father was quite a political, and he made his comments or statements within these books, but it's, they're kind of hidden away. So I'm looking to see people perhaps posting up on the Facebook page from Model Railwaymen, or I'm also going to open up a Steemit account where you can post and possibly earn some cryptocurrency for doing so.
Now, because you've got all these outsiders, sort of, you describe them as interfering in what's going on with the model railway itself, but you, the idea is a bit of a quiz here. Is what do these outsiders represent?
Yeah, it is a bit of a quiz, yeah. Because I, you know, I see, for example, in Telford in the American Visitor, the funny part of the story is that the American Visitor arrives with a cine camera, because it was back in the 70s, and the model railmen get filmed accidentally because they're interested in what is this thing that's been left on the model railway. So they end up pressing the go button and filming themselves. And so so then there has to be an explanation of, well, who are these little people? But the point is why do they have to be kept secret and protected? And who does the model? Who is the American Visitor, and what does he represent? Is this America? Can we trust America? Can we,
sounds to me like there's a lot of hidden depths in the series. I'll just run through them one more time.
Yeah,
Mark. It's the Model Railwaymen, Telford and the American Visitor, the Model Railwaymen Takeover, Telford's Holiday, Telford and the Festiniog Railway, Telford Saves the Line, Telford Goes Dutch, and Telford Tells the Truth. Now, yeah. I suppose the final question, really, Mark, is who? How do people contact you? You mentioned Facebook, but where else do you think? If people have got hold of a copy of these books, either remember them or have got some ideas about some of the hidden meanings in there,
yeah,
for you to untangle, well, how do they get hold of you?
Well, I've got the website, so that's www.themodelrowerman.uk. And there's a Facebook page and a Twitter page, so you can send comments there. So they are available on the Amazon, and or you can buy a printed copy, a new one, from Amazon or any good bookshop. They're able to order it.
One thing I will say as well is that they're quite liberally illustrated as well. I mean, do you know who did the illustrations?
Well, that was Gareth Floyd, and he did a number of lots of stuff back in the 70s on various things, including the likes of Jack and Ori. And actually, one of my father's books called One's Pool was on Jack and Ori and read out by Prunella Scales. So, yeah, Gareth Floyd did a lot of stuff, and I think and he's interested in railways, and yeah, the illustrations are great, actually.
Now, hang on, because you just mentioned there at the end another different book, which is not part of this series. So,
that's
your
right.
Dad did some other books as well, did he, or was that the only one?
He did about 16, and also a number of that are unpublished that I'm hoping to get published.
All children's books?
Yeah, yeah. Some for, you know, younger than this, and some for a bit older, but they were all basically children's books, yeah.
And it was like the 70s was a more innocent age in a way, wasn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, I think it was, yeah. Yeah. So it's a bit of a – there's quite a bit of interest in nostalgia these days, and going back to the 70s, and we've got a number of TV series that do that, and I don't know exactly why that might be, but is it a better time? Is it – why is it?
Well, I certainly think the music was better.
Probably better music. Yeah.
Maybe the writing too. Anyway, Mark Pope, thanks very much for joining us.
That's okay. Thanks a lot for inviting me, and thank you very much again.
And what we'll do is we'll give your website and the details of how to get hold of the books at the end of the show.
Right. Okay, then. Thank you.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Well, the next interview is with George Butler. He's based in Austin, Texas, and he's a talk show host with a show that goes out on the radio in Austin every Saturday evening. Now, George and I first spoke many years ago, and I think it was me first. I'm not sure, it may have been George, but we both have this thing called the special relationship. This is the special relationship we want to see between the United States and Britain, not the one that means that Britain does all these various wars for the United States. In fact, they tried to drag us into the Vietnam War even, but Harold Wilson said no. Not long after, he was forced to resign. But anyway, so that's what I think with George is a really lovely thing to have, a special relationship between Bristol and Austin, Texas. But also worth mentioning that George used to have a show on the GCN channel, which is where Alex Jones and InfoWars broadcast. But he was kicked off that channel as soon as he interviewed a guy called Miko Peled. Now, Miko Peled is the son of one of the generals from the Six-Day War, one of the big heroes of the Israeli army. But Miko himself is very critical of the Israelis. And as soon as this interview aired on the GCN channel, which is used by Alex Jones and the InfoWars people, George Butler was kicked off the show. So he's now just doing his show in Austin instead of syndicated right across the US as he used to be on GCN. Well, joining me on the line from Austin in Texas is George Butler, who does the Secret Truth radio show over there. George, whereabouts does Secret Truth go out?
Well, it broadcasts here in Austin, Texas. We've been on the air 10 and a half years, nearly 11 years. November 1st of this year will be having broadcast here in Austin.
Now, you're on here to talk about a bit of a sad event, which is the death of the author Jim Mars. Some would call him, actually, spell out for straight away that it's not M-A-R-S, it's M-A-R-R-S. Some called him a conspiracy theorist, George.
Well, I would call him a conspiracy scholar, okay? In fact, one of my friends, Eric Samuelson, coined that term years ago, and he had facts behind his reporting. He was a reporter before he got into writing in the conspiracy area. He was a police reporter and a reporter for several newspapers in the Fort Worth, Lubbock, Texas area.
Now, what got him out of the reporting for mainstream newspapers and into writing books?
Well, he was still in college at the end of right during the JFK assassination there on November 22nd, 1963. He was still in college. Jim Mars was. North Texas State, he was in undergraduate school. And so he experienced that, and then he got out and started police reporting for the Telegraph Star, the Fort Worth Telegraph Star, and a number of other reporting type of assignments, and some artistic stuff too. And then he began to take an interest back on the JFK, wanted to delve into that more. So he spent a good portion of his life finding out about JFK and the assassination.
So what was his theory about JFK, and does it hold water today?
Yes, he knows most of the players there. It took the main power people in America to make a decision, along with some of the European money people and the movers and shakers, to agree to take him out, JFK. But there were some mafia interests, and there was a CIA, the Bay of Pigs figured in, Alan Dulles had been fired. And there were several major, there was oral interest. JFK wanted to take away the oil depreciation allowance here in Texas for the independents. And then JFK wanted to pull us out of Vietnam, and that was a big no-no for the munition manufacturers. So they all got together and took him out.
Now, you mentioned Alan Dulles there, and that dovetails nicely into Jim's book about the Fourth Reich, that is to say a kind of recrudescence of the Nazis. His book was called The Rise of the Fourth Reich, because, of course, Alan Dulles was very much in touch with the Nazis during World War II, and many would say was involved in actually protecting Nazis in the United States after the war.
Yes, Jim knew the Nazi problem and the paperclip. He was a guy that delved into a lot of different major problems and wrote very, very excellent books, and they were backed up with facts. So he knew about the Nazi problem in America.
Tell us about it, though, George. I mean, paperclip, for example, some people may not know what that is.
Well, paperclip was an operation where they were told the immigration authorities were clearing people in without questions as long as they had a paperclip in the right, upper right corner of their paper documents. And they were told that if you saw someone come in and presented you documents with a paperclip in the right upper right corner, just not to hassle them, process them straight through without any questions.
And those, of course, were ex-Nazis, probably even ex-SS members.
Right. Martin Bormann was, he finally came out of Germany, too, and started operating out of Argentina, Buenos Aires. And he was overseeing many of the Nazis coming into South America and America.
Now, this network, Martin Bormann's network, was actually very well funded, wasn't it, with all of the looted gold and various other things like the bearer bonds, securities, even paintings and things like that from the whole of Europe that had been looted.
Well, there was an American that headed up the BIS in Switzerland. And Basel, and he was facilitating the Nazis' transfer of billions of dollars through the BIS to foreign banks.
So is this Fourth Reich real? I mean, this is the question, isn't it? Jim was writing about it, but, you know, is there any real basis in fact to think that there is this kind of reborn Nazi empire out there?
Yeah, there's substance and facts that back that up, because Smedley Butler uncovered a right-wing fascist conspiracy against the FDR administration in 1933.
Another subject that Jim wrote about extensively was about 9/11, wasn't it? Because he actually wrote a book all about untangling the conspiracy of 9/11. The trouble is, of course, there are lots of nonsense talked about, silly conspiracies, and I think Jim was doing quite a good job at weeding out what was the real conspiracy of 9/11 and what the lies were as opposed to the truth. So what did Jim think about 9/11?
Well, he felt like it was an inside job. It couldn't have been pulled off by anyone like bin Laden or anyone. They didn't have the technical expertise to pull it off, so it had to be an inside job. That's what he thought.
And for you, George, what are the main points of 9/11 that people should actually look at that might help them to question what they've been told? Because, you know, effectively in the weeks after it, we were just told this is what's happened, it's all been done by bin Laden, we're going into Afghanistan to get him, and that was it, really.
Right, the mass from the buildings you cannot verify on the ground after 9/11 on the main site. And then Building 7 looks like an imploded type of event. So, the main thing about 9/11, though, is the Pentagon. When you look at the Pentagon, you cannot find that 757, the parts of it in front of that Pentagon wall.
Well, some would say that the 757 yep. hit it, and so obviously those parts were inside the Pentagon.
No, the initial hole with 20 feet at the maximum in diameter. We have photographs that verify that. And then on the lawn in front of the Pentagon on that side, the fence, there was a fence and it wasn't disturbed at all. And the bodies take hours to dispose of in a fire, so they would have been strewn all across the lawn. They weren't there.
Another part of Jim Mars's repertoire was right. to do with population control. What do you understand about what he said about that, George?
Well, he knew a lot of the pharmaceutical angles and things like that, and he understood that they're practicing a population control through eugenics. He knew all about eugenics and things like that.
Now, I noticed just in the last couple of weeks, they've announced that we're moving one step closer to designer babies, where it's actually now legal to alter the human embryo in the U.S.,
Yeah, I know they've taken it way too far. And the cyborg thing and the transhumanism thing, and I think Daniel Estulin speaks to that pretty well in one of his books.
So what about, I mean, what's the point of population control?
Well, they just feel that we have way too large a population. It's come from a sustainability coming out of the Club of Rome in the 60s. they got together and created a Club of Rome, and from that came out Limits to Growth, was one of the first publications, and that put forward the idea that the world's resources were not sufficient to continue to support a growing and out of control population.
Yeah, the Limits to Growth, though, is really about economics, isn't it? About, you know, the idea that you're going to get economic growth at some point, you're not. But what advantage could they have, and who are they in population control terms?
Well, I think you've done an excellent job in the Bilderberg research over the years, and they would be at the top of this they designation. And you've done a stand-up job in reporting about the real people that control in that part of them.
Also, another one of his most recent books is The Illuminati, Secret Society That Hijacked the World. That's one of Jim's most recent books. George, do the Illuminati really exist now?
Yes, it was formed out of Ingolstadt in Bavaria in 1776. But no, there's a Wilhelmsbad conclave that gives more evidence to us. It's not very well written about. I think it occurred in 1782. And supposedly at that meeting held right outside of Frankfurt there at Wilhelmsbad, they swore, they had called in the major Masonic leaders and had them swear an oath to the Illuminati system.
And what was the point of that?
It was to consolidate the Masonic lodges under one control and designated as the Illuminati.
So that is interesting. I mean, the thing is, surely it's a bit of an exaggeration to say that the Illuminati have hijacked the world, George, because, I mean, they seem to be mainly, Freemasonry seems to be mainly powerful in the United States and in Europe, but not in places like China, who are dominated by things like the Tongs and the Triads in Southeast Asia.
Well, I think you're going to find those lodges all over the world. We know that Turkey has 300 lodges, and you wouldn't even think of them being Masonic-based at all because of Islam. But the Arabs, they have Arab lodges. The Masonic lodges are international.
So, I mean, what evidence is there then? I mean, I'm going to press you on this, that the Illuminati still exists, because this is... this is a classic kind of conspiracy theory that a lot of people will blame. If there's a plane crash, it's blamed on the Illuminati. If there's even an earthquake, that's blamed on the Illuminati. It seems like it's a good excuse to sort of scapegoat almost anything that happens.
Well, John Robison in 1796 wrote a book, Proofs of a Conspiracy. He was a leading academician and scientist out of University of Edinburgh. And he sent that book to George Washington to warn him about the takeover of the European lodges and American lodges by the Illuminati. When you say Illuminati, I would recharacterize it as the dominant financial, industrial interest in the world, that group. And they, you know, it's not just one small group anymore. I mean, these people are corporate leaders. They own big interest, but they're working together. So it's hard to designate that unless you look at the church and you look at the Knights of Malta, where they do have initiations. They do have power bases in certain places like the Le Cercle. You've got to look at Le Cercle. All of these people together conform together. You could say collectively could be described as part of the Illuminati or the power system.
Now, the interesting thing is, though, that John Robison, you just mentioned there, who wrote this book,
right,
Proofs of a Conspiracy. He was himself a Freemason, wasn't he?
Yes, he was. But he was. They tried to recruit him in before he wrote that book into the Illuminati system, and he rejected being recruited into that, and then wrote that book to warn the other lodges in UK, Scotland, and America about the intrusion or takeover by the Illuminati.
Now, George, you interviewed Jim Mars several times. You've also met him probably more times than you even interviewed him. What are your memories of him?
He was the most gentle, kind person that you'd ever want to meet. A little bit on the short side. When in his older ages, he got a little on the pudgy side. But he was a very affable, friendly person. And when he spoke to the truth, but it wasn't insulting. he could speak to these very important and dangerous matters, you could say, that are against us today or in America and Europe, but without insulting people when he spoke.
Now, many people look at the United States as the problem. I mean, you know, you look at most of the wars that have been created since the Second World War, most of them are down to the United States. So why would people trust an American to write about what's happened?
Well, Tony, that's quite a good insight. Stephen Kinzer wrote a book called The True Flag, and I interviewed him a number of months ago, but I had trouble with the recording, so it didn't go that well. But if you go back and look at that book, The True Flag, you'll see all the imperialistic intrusions that we've made throughout the world, and our country does not have a good record. You're right about that.
So why should we trust an American to write about America? Because surely, you know, that they are going to be biased towards their own country.
Well, he was a pacifist himself, Jim Marsh was. Yeah, he had his obligation to do for the service, because back then we were all subject to the draft, okay? So we either voluntarily went in for 3 years or we were drafted for 2 years into the military. So he was right in there during the Vietnam War in the service, in the Army. I think Army Intelligence is what he was in, okay? So back then it was much more of a patriotic country, and we weren't as aware of these really, you could say the deep state as we are today.
What about the interviews that you did with him? Did he surprise you in any of the things that he said?
Well, the last interview I had with him was in Dallas last November. And we talked about, he wrote a book called Crossfire, and it was about the JFK assassination. And we talked about it because we went in there one time at the Texas School Book Depository for 4 hours, and on an during one of the anniversaries, and they did not have his book in the little library there at the Texas School Book Depository museum, they call it now, but that whole museum now is set up to favor the government story about the, you know, assassin was Lee Harvey and the little cypress nest on the sixth floor and all that. But when I was interviewing, he started laughing about that book not being there, see? And that's one of the finest books you could read about the JFK assassination.
George, if you can, just explain to us why the 9/11 event is still having resonance today. You know, what happened that day, and what does it all mean for us now? I mean, if you imagine, you know, young people growing up into this world, which seems to be perpetual war, it all seems to go back to 9/11. So what really happened?
Well, there's a project for a new American century that Cheney and many of the neocons had organized before 9/11. And in one of their white papers, they speculated that what they needed was an event similar to Pearl Harbor, where they could exercise some kind of a Pearl Harbor effect. And we believe that's what 9/11 has been and is continuing to be. It was like a trauma-based system of programming for the American public in general.
But the thing is, Pearl Harbor was known about, wasn't it? Because we had the ultra decryption during World War II. Both Roosevelt and Churchill knew that the attack was coming on Pearl Harbor.
They had broken the Purple Code, which was a Japanese ambassadorial code, a diplomatic code, and they were giving messages to the we were reading their mail because of that. Yes, Roosevelt knew about Pearl Harbor and the coming attack. That's why we think one reason why they departed, all of our aircraft carriers left Pearl Harbor before the attack.
But the thing is, this was pitched to the American public and to the world through the mainstream press as a surprise attack.
Well, there were a couple of things happening. William Stevenson had been sent over by the British to do a secret mission working out of Rockefeller Center to bring America into the war as soon as possible, because Great Britain was about to have major problems in falling. And so that was one thing. And then this Pearl Harbor thing cemented our entry into the World War II.
Do you think that there are elements from World War II that we can learn from today, George, as an ex-military man yourself?
Yeah, there was one fellow that I think he passed away, and I never interviewed him, but he wrote a very important book about the Fourth Reich or something up there close to Bristol.
Harry Beckhoff.
Yeah, that
and I think Harry's books, Harry's book is, I think, is called Four Reichs or something. But Harry was the longest standing member of the Conservative Party. He was a member of the Marlborough Conservative Association, and I was very privileged to interview him a couple of times. Very sad to see, though, that his son at his funeral was almost kind of taking the mickey out of him as a conspiracy theorist. That was a pretty disappointing. But Harry was particularly adamant that the European Union was a kind of conspiracy. So anyway, so to get back to the original question, George, what sort of evidence do you think there is for this, the modern kind of situation that we're in, and what can we do about it?
Well, I think 9/11 speaks for itself. It just, those buildings fell at almost a free fall rate. That meant they had to have help. We know bin Laden didn't have the technical knowledge to do it or the access to the buildings. There were no plane parts out in front of the Pentagon, so they've been lying to us about those things. So I think we just have to. I think the most important thing is 9/11 right now. I really do.
And what can we do about it, George? This is the point.
I think we need to start talking about it again and bringing it up again.
Why is that?
Because it's been the tool that they've used to take us around and do what they want to.
Well, you know, we don't get very much opinion from ordinary Americans, certainly not from round Austin way. But can you give us an idea of what most Americans think about Americans' power and projection and image in the world? Do you think that they're still proud of America as a country?
Well, I think you have two groups that are, you know, in opposition. You have the conservative people that voted for Trump, and they're more your typical patriotic Americans. They're still, patriotic issues will still affect them. And then you have the progressive left, I think, that is sick and tired of any more wars and so forth. So right now it's sort of a divided America that we have. But our school systems don't teach anything about American history anymore. So, you know, we're just getting children with the millennials that don't. One of them told me the other day, they said, some old white guys wrote the Constitution. That's what one of them told me. So you're getting some really parroted responses from some of these young people. They have no historical, you know, view of anything.
They don't really know the detail. That's the trouble. George, but I suppose I come back again to this question of what we can do apart from just being aware. I mean, there is obviously this very powerful force in the Western world which is taking us from one war to the next, regime change to regime change. The latest one seems to be pointing its finger at North Korea and even at Russia, regime change there. What do you think is going to be over the next 4 years with Donald Trump in charge? What's it going to be like, George?
I like his conservative views that he espoused on the campaign trail. Right now, the latest scandal that is broken has been with McMaster as the national security advisor. And he's been surrounded by the neocons. So we're getting a warlike footing still. That's very dangerous for the country. I would say that Trump has some problems, the ego and all that. But most of all, he doesn't have the view that JFK had. JFK had a much broader philosophical, political view and international view. And Trump has been concentrating on business. So he's got these neocons he's still listening to some, and they're actually got his ear. And it's just a reiteration of what Obama was doing, but in a little different way.
I mean,
more warlike.
I mean, for example, in Guam this week, there's been the threat by North Korea against Guam, which actually happens fairly regularly. And I was listening to some of the commentators who live on Guam here on the BBC, and they're saying, well, in the past, the American response to these threats against us from North Korea was measured. Under Trump, it seems to be just as fanatical as the North Koreans.
Yeah, I don't like his commentary or his response recently, because it sounds like he's going to launch an attack at any moment, and that could be the worst thing. Seoul is only 30-35 miles from the DMZ, and it would be a catastrophe for South Korea's economy. Is bigger than Russia's economy. Okay,
amazing.
And that shows how it's important not to be too rash in your. He was too rash on his attack in Syria. He didn't have the intelligence, and now he's getting fed all this stuff from the neocons, and they're on the war side. It's not good.
Finally, George, what are people's reactions to Trump in the U.S. now? Because, I mean, he was elected on a pro-Russia ticket, rapprochement with Russia. Well, the latest is he's just been filmed sheepishly signing some sort of presidential order or law into force to massively increase sanctions against Russia, which, of course, is a form of economic warfare.
Well, he's carrying out the same thing Brzezinski had before he passed away, that same hard line against the Russians. And we don't need that kind of a policy. But what I'm saying is that they have him under control right now, and he's doing things that are disappointing to the conservatives. They're not happy with some of the things that he's been doing like that. But on the other hand, he has the influx of the immigrants down. He is deporting the illegal immigrants that are felons and things like that. So he is doing some things that the electorate wanted.
So I said finally, but I'm going to say finally again now. So what lessons has Jim Mars taught us that will help us to understand what's going on in the world today with this potential war coming? Maybe this is all saber-rattling and it's all just about fear, George. What can Jim teach us?
Jim is teaching us, I think, in his, you know, with his publications and his life's work, that the JFK thing to him was all important, because the same group and the same power block that carried out that are still in place today in America and Europe, and they're causing the same problems for us.
George, where can people find you online?
TheSecretTruth.com.
And if you happen to live in Austin, Texas, where can we pick you up?
At 89.1 FM on the radio here in Austin on Saturday night, 7 to 9.
All right, George, thanks very much for joining us.
Okay, thank you, Tony.
That's all for this week, Dialects Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast. You can download it to listen to on your phone or in the car. You can subscribe and listen the week before broadcast at dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests, local man Mark Pope, whose father was writing about children's railway stories. And also, thanks very much to you just heard there, George Butler, about the death of US conspiracy scholar Jim Mars. Also, thanks to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialects of Bristol Broadband Co-op production. Catch us on Bristol Community FM 93.2 in Bristol every Tuesday at noon, and anyone can contribute. Contact us through the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street, on 0117 909 6897. You can also find them on the web at prsc.org.uk, or via the National Volunteering website, which has volunteer opportunities right across the country. That's on do-it.org. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week. Goodbye for now.
Millersdale for Tideswell, Kirby Muxlow, Mal Cop and Scholar Green. No more will I go to Blandford Forum and Morty Ho. On the slow train from Midsummer Norton and Mumby Road. No churns, no porter, no cat on a seat at Chorlton Cumharney or Chester the Street. We won't be meeting again on the slow train. I'll travel no more from Littleton Battersea to Openshaw, at Long Stanton, I'll stand well clear of the doors no more. No whitewashed pebbles, no up and no down, from four before crosses to Dunstable Town. I won't be going again on the slow train. On the main line and the good siding, the grass grows high at Dog Dyke, Tumby Woodside, and Trouble House Halt. The sleeper sleep at Audlem and Ambergate. No passenger waits on Chittering platform or Cheslin Hay. No one departs, no one arrives, from Selby to Goole, from St. Earth to St. Ives. They've all passed out of our lives on the slow train, on the slow train. Cockermouth for Buttermere,
on the slow train.
Armley Moor, Adam, Pye Hill and Summercoats,
on the slow train.
Windmill End,
much too much in love to say goodnight.